This week, we got a small window into the world of U.S. intelligence operations overseas, with news that the CIA pulled one of its most valuable spies out of Russia in 2017 over concerns about his safety. The spy reportedly worked close to President Vladimir Putin and had provided the U.S. government with information on Russian interference efforts for the 2016 election. The extraction reportedly left the United States with little insight into what happens at some of the highest levels of the Russian government at a critical moment. David Sanger is a senior writer and national security correspondent for The New York Times. David, thanks for coming back on The Takeaway.
Great to be with you, Tensia.
So what do we know about the person and the information that they were providing to the U.S. government? Because it seems like if we're talking about Russian interference in the 2016 election, that's something we need to know.
Well, in fact, as you know, we've known a fair bit about the information and the existence of this person since 2016, since the elections. And in The Perfect Weapon, a book I wrote about cybersecurity issues, I wrote that the CIA director under President Obama, John Brennan, was in the summer of 2016 bringing reports to the White House in a separate envelope. He wouldn't put it in the presidential daily brief because they came from very high-level assets that they had in and around Putin's orbit, and that one in particular had been particularly productive. And that this was, in the end, how they established that Putin himself had ordered the hack on the DNC, had ordered many of the other interference activities that we later came to know about. And at the end of 2016, the Obama administration, just before leaving office, made an effort to exfiltrate him, bring him to the United States. And he resisted, we understood at that time, said that it was for family reasons. I mean, who knows? But that happens at times. What we've learned in recent days is that they succeeded in 2017, shortly after President Trump took over. He did come to the United States. And then, of course, the Russians leaked out his name once the stories began appearing. And then once the name leaked out, of course, the oddity is we began to find references to it on the internet in land transactions from apparently when he purchased a house.
Why would the Russian media publish his name?
Because they wanted to establish that he really wasn't terribly important. When you read the Russian accounts from him, they say that he had a drinking problem. They say that he was low level, that he was never near Putin, and so forth and so on. I can't speak to the drinking issues, but we certainly can speak to the question of the quality of the information we got. And based on our sources, it was quite good. We believe, in fact, that he was an aide to a very senior Russian diplomat who's assigned to the Kremlin. So while he wasn't based in the Kremlin himself, he was likely in and out and certainly had access through one of Putin's top aides to what was going on.
Has there been any official response from the Russian government and or the U.S. government so far?
The U.S. government has said nothing, as you would expect, about an agent that they repatriated. And I can understand why you want to protect the name and the whereabouts of this kind of person. They're rightly concerned about his safety. From the Russian government, we have not heard anything that would suggest official acknowledgement. But then they had many of their semi-official news organizations, including Kommersant, publish these sort of disinformation stories to denigrate him.
David, you almost think that it's almost impossible for spies to be found out. I mean, this is part of why they're spies, right? When they are extracted to the U.S. or to other countries, what are some of the risks that they face?
Well, the greatest example, of course, is the Skripal case, which was a case of a spy for the British who had been caught in Moscow, imprisoned, and returned to Britain in a spy swap. And they thought at that point, you know, people would sort of leave him alone. Well, it turned out that because he had been rather active and going off and talking about Russia and its intelligence networks to other countries and so forth, that he was the subject, of course, of that terrible nerve agent attack a year and a half ago. So there is considerable risk, particularly these days. The Russians have not attempted something like that nerve agent attack in the United States, and there are reasons to doubt that they would. But you never know, and I think that's part of the concern here.
David, the Washington Post said that they were able to find the home of the man the Russian media is naming as the CIA source right outside of D.C. Now, if this is actually the home of this alleged spy, doesn't it put him at risk and his family at risk to report all of this information out to the public?
It certainly does. And we found the home as well. And one of our reporters, Julian Barnes, went out there as well. But what we don't know is whether the name that the Russians are putting out is in fact the spy in question. I mean, we can't 100% verify that. All of the circumstantial evidence seems to suggest it was. And it does raise a really interesting question that since the CIA has this fairly detailed and super secret relocation program where they take people and they give them new identities and so forth, why would this person have bought a house in the Washington suburbs under his own name? And the answer to that, I'm told by some intelligence officials, is that sometimes people who come here do not want to, in fact, take on a new identity. They want to live in the open. They want to be proud of what they did. And they don't believe that Putin would go after them on American soil.
And of course, bringing it back to the election here in 2020, what does this story tell us, if anything, about how we think about the U.S. intelligence community and Russian interference in our elections more broadly, but also the concern about that as we head into this 2020 presidential election?
Well, the concern is deep and wide in the U.S. government, with one exception, which is the president, with whom they can't discuss the topic, as Kirstjen Nielsen noted shortly before and after she was relieved as the Secretary of Homeland Security. The president views any discussion of this issue as an attack on the legitimacy of his own election. But certainly you're seeing the Department of Homeland Security, the National Security Agency, the FBI, other units of the U.S. government trying to think ahead to 2020. And there's one thing we know, which is that whatever the Russians do, they're not going to replay the same playbook that they used in 2016, because Facebook would be waiting for them, Twitter would be waiting for them. There are some things we are deeply worried about, and one of them I've written about in recent times in The Times, that if you've seen this wave of ransomware attacks that have hit the states over the summer, it's an interesting question. What would happen if there was a ransomware attack that hit the voter registration systems, and when you went to the polling places, they were frozen up and they couldn't establish that you were who you said you were or that you hadn't moved to Arizona last week or something like that?
David Sanger, senior writer and national security correspondent for the New York Times. David, we appreciate you joining us today.
Always great to be with you.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.